This is the current federal tax developments for the week of June the 10th, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers here from Phoenix again this week, and we are going to be talking to you about some updates that took place in this week, most significant of which is a United States Supreme Court decision that will have a major impact on buy-sell agreements that are structured for an entity as a life insurance policy owned by the entity, which is then used to redeem the interest of one or more of the equity holders, depending upon how its structure goes. Next, we also are going to look at a taxpayer who was denied relief for late rollover of her employer retirement plan funds when she accidentally, it appears, ended up transferring those funds, or at least somehow they got moved, instead of into a traditional IRA, which is the type of account that could actually hold this transfer, into a Roth IRA that had been established, which turns out is a problem because you can't really go directly from a traditional 401k structure rolling directly into a Roth IRA. You would need to go through an interim step of getting into a traditional IRA, which then you eventually could convert to a Roth. But that's not how this process. Next up, we had the IRS also made a ruling this week on 139 payments related to the East Palestine, Ohio derailment. 139, as we discussed a while back, is a provision that allows an exclusion from income for certain payments made to an individual that are related to a qualified disaster. This is an interesting ruling, obviously very interesting if you have clients who are impacted by that. It's also interesting because it gives a pretty good look, an overview of the types of things that will be considered allowed as 139 reimbursements and the type of things that will not be allowed. And finally, we'll look at what options out there exist. If you have an employer who has a pending claim for the employee retention tax credit, and the IRS hasn't moved on it now for a long time. You know, they filed, let's say, back a year ago. You know, it's been a year and they still haven't heard what options exist, what's going on about that. And we're going to find out there are options. They just aren't necessarily very good options, but there are options to accelerate the process. Actually, one option, it's just going to be a problematical one. Well, let's talk first about that Supreme Court decision. We are getting here in the summer. This is when the court issues a bunch of its larger decisions. And this particular decision may have a major impact on structuring for estate planning and dealing with structures to redeem deceased shareholders in the case of a, let's say, small, closely held entity. We'll talk a little bit about that here. This was involving a structure of, you have a buy-sell arrangement where a corporation owns life insurance on each of its shareholders. When a shareholder dies, the company is basically required to redeem those shares for a price determined under some agreement. And that redemption, you know, basically allows the company to continue operating as it has before. You know, the old shareholder is bought out and the remaining shareholders would continue to operate the company as is. Now, that structure was challenged by the IRS back in 2005. And there, the 11th Circuit ruled that when you value that entity, so we have, you know, we have basically ABC Corp here. Joe dies, suddenly $4 million goes into ABC Corp, right? So we have Joe, we have Harry, they are the shareholders of the company. So that $4 million goes into the company upon Joe's death. However, the company is obligated to redeem the Joe shares or $4 million. And let's assume that, we'll ignore discounts for a moment. Let's assume that in fact they're equal shareholders and the company is worth $8 million. So we get the $4 million. We redeem Joe $4 million. His family gets $4 million. And whoever his heirs are, we should say, presumably his family. And then in the other hand, you know, the other shareholder ends up with a company 100% interest in, which is worth $8 million, right? At this point, right? It was worth $8 million before it got the money. It gets the money, but it sends it right out to Joe's family. So therefore, it's there. Now, the 11th Circuit said that when valuing the company, We ignored the fact of it getting that $4 million because that $4 million had an offsetting liability of, let's say in this case, assuming the two were equal, $4 million to redeem the decedent's shares. As such, those essentially wipe each other out, so we only look at the value of the company before he died. That was not something the IRS was thrilled with, and they did recently bring a challenge in the Eighth Circuit. And the Eighth Circuit had ruled in basically the same situation that you do not consider the liability when valuing the company. So if the company was worth $8 million, it gets $4 million of cash, basically, you know, ignoring all the issues for valuation that we'd otherwise play with, but just on a simple basis, no discounts or anything. Well, certainly the company as a whole would appear to be worth $4 million more. It's got $4 million cash. That's fairly liquid. As you might guess, that makes a significant difference in how much estate tax would be owed by Joe's estate related to Joe's interest. Because if Joe owns one half interest in a company worth $12 million, that's a $6 million interest that passed to Joe. You know, the past at Joe, that, you know, when it, that was transferred at Joe's passing, and that would cause an additional estate tax to exist on $2 million additional dollars, right? In essence, the one half of the proceeds. So this was a major split, you know, became a problem. The Eighth Circuit was very aware they were disagreeing with the 11th, but they disagreed. One of the key disagreements they had was they said, look, at the end of the day, we got that fact pattern. Joe has, you know, as I said, the problem is that we have $8 million worth of assets, you know, loaned between the two of them, $4 million of which, let's say, theoretically was Joe's. So let's accept that. If we structure it as a redemption, when Joe dies, Joe's family gets $4 million. So far, so good. Joe had a $4 million asset. Joe's family gets $4 million. Okay. The only problem is also getting $4 million is the other shareholder. Because now that shareholder went from owning 50% of an $8 million company, or effectively a value of, ignoring discounts, $4 million, owning 100% of an $8 million company. So effectively, we've had a transfer of $4 million representing, you know, the value of the shares before he passed away, along with, indirectly, another $4 million. And so the problem becomes, you know, how in the world does that work, right? Isn't there an untaxed amount of gain here? And the Eighth Circuit said there is, and therefore, nope, you've got to consider that what was owned and what a willing buyer would buy immediately upon Joe's death, they would have paid for 50% of those of the shares. They would have paid half of the $12 million. Therefore, the value of the shares are six. Well, now we go to the court. Now, this, you know, closely-held entities using life insurance to fund buy-sell agreements, you know, that's pretty normal, right? We see that a lot. They use life insurance for that purpose. Because, you know, it's a liability in the future. It does not require consuming company assets. And the company, therefore, will continue to operate just as it did before. If you had to actually redeem out and pay out the half, you know, the 50% interest, that's going to, at best, put a large liability on the, you know, on there. And so you're going to have this big debt and interest to pay off. Or they're going to have to actually start selling off assets to be able to make that payment to the estate to buy those shares. So buy-sell agreements may arguably not really be feasible for closely held companies unless you can fund it with life insurance in some ways. Now, there are two options to do so. One option, which doesn't run into any of the issues you're going to have in this case, is the concept of a cross-purchase agreement. Instead of the company owning two $4 million policies, one on each of its shareholders, rather, each shareholder would own a single $4 million policy on the life of the other shareholder. When the shareholder dies, right, when one shareholder dies, the other shareholder would receive the $4 million of proceeds, and that could then be used to buy those shares from Joe's estate. This presents no problem, you know, doesn't present the theoretical problem we're going to have with the redemption. Because what happens in this case is Joe's family gets $4 million worth of stock. Now, under the stock agreement, they are mandated to sell that back to the other shareholder. The other shareholder is mandated to pay them the $4 million. So because of that, you know, the other shareholder gets the money. The other shareholder pays Joe's family the $4 million. Now, again, that shareholder owns 100% of the company, but that was funded out of life insurance that that shareholder paid for. Quite often, people don't like that structure. There are a couple of reasons for it. One is there is some risk that your shareholder might end up not actually, you know, funding the policy. He might end up being, you know, he didn't make the payments, he ran out of, you know, he had financial issues, things happened, and suddenly there is no money to buy out the other parties. And now you got a total mess. You have a shareholder who is obligated to pay, you know, something he can't pay. The other people have shares in a company they may have nothing to do with, right? We've got a total disastrous mess here to straighten out. So to avoid those sorts of things, and the other issue is, I'll be blunt, for whatever reason, even though it will be non-deductible when paid by the corporation, most shareholders have an easier time with the corporation writing a check, even if they own the entire corporation, than they do with personally writing a check. So even though in theory we have the same two policies, in theory we have the same cost, in theory, yeah, they're both going to have to pay it with after-tax funds, it's just easier for people to accept the company paying it. So where we often see structures here is the more popular has been the concept of a redemption agreement. Instead of the company, instead of the shareholders owning policies on each other, which also can get very complicated. If you have two shareholders, not that tough. But what happens if you have six, seven, eight, nine shareholders? There's a lot of policies in play here that have to be purchased by everybody for their share of, you know, the number of shares held by somebody else. That's a lot of policies. That's going to add a lot of additional costs, in essence, because each insurance policy comes with a lot of admin costs to go with it. And having that many policies in play is going to just, you know, there's going to be a bit more friction and a bit more admin costs involved. So lots of reasons why the redemption seems to make a lot more sense, right? One policy on each shareholder and the company holds it. When the shareholder dies, the company redeems their shares and everything goes on like normal. So redemption agreements have been, in my experience, the far more popular way to handle this. But there is that concern that most people thought was addressed back in 2005 in the 11th Circuit Blount case, that, you know, isn't there a transfer of, you know, a transfer of wealth going on here that's being not taxed? Well, now the court, now basically the IRS found a case that they decided to take up and fight on the issue again. We have a corporation owned by two brothers in this case. Michael Connolly held 77.18% of the shares, and his brother Thomas held the remaining 21.82%. Okay. The buy-sell agreement provided that at either brother's death, an independent valuation would be undertaken that would set the price to be paid for that brother's shares. The surviving brother would first have the option to acquire the shares at fair market value. If the surviving brother did not, you know, take up that option to buy him or herself, then the company would be required to, you know, basically redeem the shares at that price. Now, this type of structure would have allowed them to use a cross purchase, right? Each brother could have gotten insurance on the other's life and then bought the shares, but it also allowed them to go back into the company structure. And so what they really had planned to do, obviously, was have the company, you know, redeem the shares. Neither brother, at least, or certainly not Thomas, had a life insurance policy on the other that would have given him the funds immediately to buy out his brother's much larger interest in the company. Now, Michael died in 2013. So remember, he's the by far majority shareholder. He dies in 2013. Okay. Now, the problem was that, in fact, we didn't have the valuation take place, right? Thomas, who was the executor, did not have valuation performed, but rather he negotiated a fair price with Michael's son. So he and Michael decided that $3 million would be a fair price. and he paid Michael $3 million for the shares. The corporation had a $3.5 million life insurance policy on Michael's life. Therefore, when it redeemed it for $3 million, right, Thomas reported the value of the shares as $3 million on Michael's estate tax return, signed off, and put it through that way. Now, of course, the IRS didn't really buy that one, is what happened here. You know, when they examined the return, Thomas did obtain a valuation. The firm valuing the interest took the position, basically they followed Blount, the 11th Circuit case from 2005, that the redemption price was a liability to be considered. Basically, so there was only a $500,000 bump up in value when they got $3.5 million of proceeds, and they were going to use that to pay off $3 million of, you know, the value of the 77%+ interest deceased shareholder. And then the other $500,000 presumably would be used to take care of some other issues. You know, due to Michael's death, the company might face, there are some additional challenges, etc. So it gave the company some funds to work through that period. Now, I suspect why the IRS decided to challenge this one to a certain extent goes because Thomas didn't follow the estate plan. You know, like it or not, I think that may have been what got the question started by the examining agent who thought this might be a good plan to move forward on, because they might get it simply because he didn't follow the plan, or they might get a bigger win, which apparently is what they're going to get in this case. Now, as I said, the IRS disagreed. They said the redemption proceeds did not reduce the value of the entity. Finding the value of the entity's value of Michael's shares was the adjustment was $5.3 million, not $3 million, right? They adjusted it up. They changed the valuation, probably had a couple of other discussion points. But in any event, they booked the company up to $5.3 million, right? Giving him basically a share of generally one half of the $3.5 million. You know, that, or basically of the, you know, giving him with 77% of the $3.5 million, roughly. So essentially that bumped up his value. Now, obviously, since this was a taxable estate, which also is important to remember, that extra $2.3 million of value was going to come at a cost, right? It's either, you know, it's one of those issues that we run into. In this case, the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, sided with the IRS, and I think that's important. Not only did this case have no dissenting justices who said this was decided in error, it really should have been decided just like Blount. You know, Blount case should have, you know, it should have been the Blount case should have controlled this. But we didn't even have concurring decisions. Concurring decisions are where they agree with the result, but they disagree with how you got there. So fundamentally, every justice signed off on the decision that was penned by Justice Thomas to how, why this didn't work and how. Nobody did a concurring saying, well, the only problem was, you know, it would have worked just fine if Thomas had actually followed the agreement. Nobody said that in the opinion. No, nobody said, nope, the reasoning is not that life insurance has to be counted. The reasoning is Thomas didn't follow the agreement. And I found that interesting because I thought somebody might go down that path, but they didn't. The key factor was the court finding that untaxed transfer of wealth, right? Until Michael dies, you know, in the Connolly family, considering Michael, his family, Thomas, his family, there was between them owned an asset that was a corporation that, if you believed Thomas, was worth somewhat around $3.8 million. Forget what number it worked up to, but in any event. So they said it was worth something along that, right? And that was the only asset they had. But Michael dies, and once the dust settles, Michael's family has a $3 million asset, theoretically the value of the 77% that existed on the day Michael died. Okay, fine. But Thomas went from owning just over a fifth of that $3.8 million company to owning 100% of it. How'd that happen? And that's where the court's concerned, that Thomas had a windfall. that was not being taxed. You know, in essence, that's a problem, and that's why you have to include the life insurance when you determine the value. That a willing buyer buying an undifferentiated 50% of the shares in the company would have demanded half, you know, would have paid half the value. That would have included that $3.5 million extra sitting in the bank account. They would have paid for it. You know, and for if they'd gotten not 50% here, but 70%, they'd have paid for at least 78% of that. So that's the court's key concern, right? You know, and the specifically the oral arguments and in the case, it was clearly oral arguments that this untaxed wealth transfer was bothering the court. And it's pretty clear in the decision, they decided to decide it based effectively upon that. That a company, when it redeems its shares, has to go down in value. So, you know, there is no way we could say it was worth $3.8 million before it redeemed its shares and was worth $3.8 million after it redeemed its shares. Right, it when it redeems shares, it redeems an equity interest, which is what Michael owned. It has to go down in value. That's going to be their basis. So Michael got $3 million in exchange for his father's interest, and Thomas owned 100% of the company. That is a big problem from the Supreme Court's viewpoint. The justices believed in oral arguments the transfer of value to Thomas was going to go effectively untaxed if the court followed the 11th Circuit's ruling, which they declined to do. They were not going to go down that route. Now, the real problem we have is this case raises serious questions about the use of redemption agreements, where the insurance policies to fund the agreement are held by the entity. Now, I should say, before you panic too much, if in fact none of the shareholders, regardless of which way you value the company, is going to have a taxable estate in excess of, let's assume that the rates go down. Let's assume that, in fact, the exclusion goes down in 2026. My own leaning is I think it will actually get restored because it's not that expensive. And, you know, and it appears that traditionally it's been a really significant point for the Republicans to get this in. The Democrats have complained, will complain about it, but will back down every time. That's what's happened in the past. So I see other ones being much tougher to deal with in extending Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but this will stay around. But let's assume worst case it goes away. It's still going to be an inflation-adjusted $5 million. So we're still looking at the state of over $6 million. That means that for 99% probably of business owners, this decision is irrelevant unless the exclusion goes way down, like back to where we were before the economic recovery, you know, economic, ACTRA, whatever that was, Economic Growth, whatever act that it was back in 2001. You know, if we start getting down to $1 million exclusions, then yeah, this case would have a huge impact on a lot of clients. But at this point, you have to realize that the number of estates that are over $6 million, even when including two spouses and their combined estates, is relatively small, even among business owners, right? Now, once you get there, this is then a huge case. So this suggests that while you might not want to disrupt a buy-sell that is for, let's say, a company that maybe is worth in total $1 million, and the shareholders, you know, each personally, you know, maybe they have estates of $2 to $3 million, right? It's not going to cause a problem. Going to cause a problem, though, where we see estates that are worth, you know, either standalone or with the spouses that are worth over, you know, $6 million, $7 million, it could complicate matters horribly or at least get us close enough that we worry about it. So that's where we're going to find our problems. And obviously, if your estate's worth $20 or $30 million, then yeah, this is a huge problem if your company is a major source of that money. Right. So we're going to see how this goes. It depends. Or at least you have companies in there. We're going to worry about it. Now, this is the catch. Basically, the taxpayers tried to argue that you don't want to side this the other way because it's going to so horribly complicate estate planning for small, closely held businesses. And to be quite honest, the court was kind of tough luck. Right. Yeah, we realize that. Life's tough. didn't quite phrase it that way, but it's pretty close. Fundamentally, what they're saying. I mean, it's pointed out in the decision that a cross-purchase arrangement, which, by the way, with only two shareholders, was way more feasible to be done than if you have five, six, seven shareholders. So two shareholders, a cross-purchase agreement, still have some concerns, but it's way easier to structure than it is when you have six, seven, eight shareholders. A cross-purchase agreement would have eliminated the problem entirely. You chose to use a redemption. Maybe you chose it because you thought this was settled law, which I'm sure is why they did, but the Supreme Court had never ruled on it. It's an interesting warning to say that be very, very careful when it appears that the circuits, you know, that like a circuit decided something, the IRS has never raised the question again. But we've never really had a case in a bunch of other circuits raising this issue. There is a chance, as this case makes clear, that the IRS decides to raise the case in another circuit. That circuit decides in favor of the IRS, and the Supreme Court sides with the IRS and the other circuit. Just what happened here. So, any event, if any clients you have that have an existing buy-sell arrangement that is funded by company-owned life insurance, you probably need to consider if it should be looked at again, not only whether if somebody died today there would be a problem, but also what happens if the exclusion goes down to its scheduled amount come up in 2006, and potentially, you know, how much room do you have before we would start getting nervous? How much are the estates worth of the shareholders? How much would this change in valuation affect the shares? And, you know, does that put anybody at risk of paying estate taxes? And then we have to kind of figure out how to work with that. Next up, we have private letter ruling 2024-23009. This one came down on June the 7th. Now, this is a taxpayer who's trying to do a direct rollover from her employer retirement plan to a traditional IRA. She requested a trustee-to-trustee transfer to the financial institution that she believed had set up a traditional IRA to receive the funds. We're never told why in her facts as to why. And I think the fact that we're not told why may tell us kind of what she couldn't, you know, because I'm sure the IRS came back and asked for some details here, and she couldn't really come up with the details they would need to say there was an institutional error here, which is what she claimed. Now, funds went in. It turns out it went into a traditional IRA rather than a Roth. Went into a Roth IRA, I should say, instead of a traditional IRA, right? She did not notice the problem until she received a Form 5498, at which point it was discovered that the IRA account set up was a Roth account. So, yeah, oops. And I kind of wouldn't be surprised to discover that it was her tax advisor that noted this. You know, how clients always like to say 5498's over, you know, in the summer, they receive them. Oh, this just came in. You know, does this change my taxes? We always get those every year. And I can imagine this one coming in. Of course, the tax professional looks at it because, yeah, you're going to look at it, but your theory is it's not going to change your taxes. And then you suddenly notice it says it's a Roth IRA. And now we got a problem because, of course, she told you she direct transferred it into, you know, an IRA, a traditional IRA with this. And now it's like, you know, Mary, did you transfer this to a traditional IRA? You know, basically, it's like, this is a Roth IRA. You can't move it directly to a Roth. Now there's a problem because the funds have left the plan and they are sitting in the Roth IRA, which, by the way, is not allowed to, you know, what you have there effectively now is an excess contribution to the Roth, right? If we can't fix this. So we got a big problem. We have failed to do a rollover and we have an excess, we're going to pay tax on the money and there's going to be an excess contribution inside the Roth, and there's all kinds of disasters working from that point forward. So this is, shall we say, a mess. Well, first, they're trying to fix the rollover itself. Just get it done. Right? As I noted, when you want, if you do, could you move it from your 401k account, and could it eventually end up in a Roth IRA? Yes. But you would have to, the rollover, though, has to go to traditional IRA. Now, once it's in there, then, just like the backdoor Roth normally, assuming you have no other funds, right, no other traditional IRAs, you could then plop it straight over into the Roth IRA, similar to a backdoor Roth contribution. But you have to do the parking in the interim. Just like if your client who can't make a contribution to a Roth IRA tries to put the contribution directly into the Roth IRA instead of going through traditional, it doesn't work. So we have a problem here. It's sitting outside the fund. The 60-day clock starts running. It obviously had long run. So the fact of just pull the funds out of there, Mary, push it into the regular IRA, and we're fine. We're beyond the 60 days. So we need, at the very least, to solve one problem, we need to get relief from the late rollover. So we're trying to get relief and saying we go beyond 60 days, right? We need to get beyond that point. So Mary's asking for relief, right? Because she didn't realize there's a problem until we were past the end of the 60th day. So we need permission to put those funds into a traditional IRA. The problem was we're going to have trouble getting them, right? We talked about the parking. We talked about the other problem. Now, the IRS is authorized to grant relief under 402C3B, get that stated correctly, where a failure would be against equity or good conscience. If that's the case, then we are allowed to get relief. The IRS can grant it. In Revenue Procedure 2003-16, the IRS outlined the conditions under which they would be willing to grant such relief, right? And one of the ways they would do it is if the late rollover was due in entirety to financial institution's error. If the institution fouled up, then, you know, that will get you a reprieve, right? She is going to argue that is what happened here, right? But the problem is the IRS did not agree, you know, at least based on what she was able to show, that she had actually been harmed by the financial institution. That in essence, that they'd be the party responsible for either establishing a Roth IRA when it was supposed to be in traditional, or they had been the party responsible for placing the funds into a Roth IRA when it should have been placed in the traditional IRA. That's her argument with this, the IRS. The problem is, it's tough to show that. The problem is how, you know, you've got to show a clear error. So there's where her problem arises, right? Normally to do this, I need to show a specific step the institution took that was clearly erroneous. For instance, let's say she has a copy of the account application she filled out. The account application clearly states that she is establishing a traditional IRA. She was not establishing any other type of IRA at the same time. So there is no other, right? The only account that should be at the institution, she has no other account at this institution. The only account that should be at this institution is a traditional IRA, and she clearly and properly filled in the paperwork or clearly and properly opened the account electronically online and checked all the proper boxes, and she can show that, right? All of that was done, but somehow the bank, probably if she used a paper form, fouled up when keying it in, and because of that, she now has a Roth IRA instead of traditional. She did not show that, right? We were never told that anything like that happened. If the error was simply because she accidentally got confused on the form, but ended up checking the box that said Roth IRA, because she didn't read it carefully enough, or she had two accounts over there and she managed to write down the wrong account number, or just, just totally failed, and they're going to have a little trouble that she never noticed with the statement she got that they said Roth IRA. So because she could not show a financial institution only error, by the way, the labeling on the state would be easier to take if in fact she only had one account there and it was a non-Roth, then there was a little reason for her to pay a lot of attention to the title there that said Roth IRA. In any event, she couldn't show this stuff, so she lost it. And generally, it helps most if the institution itself will admit the error. You know, it's going to be a lot simpler if that is true. In this case, she failed to give or prove sufficient details on how the Roth IRA either came into being, was used to receive the funds, and how it was the banks happen. If I had to guess, I think one of the ways this could happen fairly easily is if, let's say, she had these funds in a 401k. And, you know, you really looked at that and think, you know, in her situation, looking at her overall financial picture, she would probably be better off to have those funds, you know, transferred to a Roth IRA, pay tax currently, have those funds transferred to a Roth IRA, you know, and get rid of the required minimum distributions. Perhaps that's a big problem. Allow for a little bit more of a stretch, you know, on the back end when she dies, because, you know, the heirs, there's, you know, that won't be great, but they could take it out over lifetime. So there's a little bit there, some stretch, but whatever, not what we used to have. But in any event, you know, we'd have, you know, we could be able to maybe do this. So maybe the plan was that we were going to take the funds from her retirement account. We wanted to get them to a Roth IRA. Obviously, as a tax professional, we know there are steps she should have taken. Obviously, they weren't taken in the proper order. But I could very easily see how if the tax pro was not involved every step of the way, that it could easily get confused where either she or the financial institution, you know, got confused. Or more appropriately, the financial institution was never brought into the loop about what was supposed to happen. And rather, Mary took care of filling in the forms. And at the end of the day, we have this mistake, we have this error. And the problem is, I have a feeling that if we really look at how the account got set up, or how the funds got transferred in there, the taxpayer was probably involved in it in some way, shape, or form, which led to the problem. And so we're stuck. We have some more guidance on 139a payments. 139a payments. This is IRS Notice 2024-46, came out on June 6. This involves the train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio in 2003. And certain payments made by the railroad to individuals impacted by the disaster. Now, this is 139. We discussed it during the pandemic. You know, if you reimburse people for expenses incurred due to a qualified disaster, and East Palestine, Ohio's derailment was declared a federal disaster, so we got the basics in there. Certain of those payments are not taxable. So what this ruling will tell us is that the East Palestine, Ohio incident qualifies as such a disaster, which really wasn't in question. But then also specific payment types, because there were certain things happened there, and they're going to talk about specific payment types, which ones are excludable, which ones aren't, and how you should file the returns, or how you should file amended returns if you claim them as taxable for that year. So first thing is, as I said, clearly say this is a qualified disaster under 139. Again, not surprising, pretty much has to be. But the question is going to be, what payments are excludable and what type of payments aren't? So in Section 2, they made a ruling about certain payments by the common carrier, that is the railroad, made to victims directly. Which ones of those were excludable from their income? My guess is they were reported on a 1099 by the railroad, because they're going to report everything on that. They don't care. You know, that's how it's going to go. So this is kind of to deal with that. The payments you could exclude included, and these are listed. And notice it says include, which means that there could be others that could fit in here, but you have to go to 139 itself here. These are just granted automatic relief status. Payments or reimbursements of relocation expenses, including payments for hotels, meals, gas, other fuel, pet boarding, and replacement of clothing or personal items. You know, you had to quickly leave your home. You're not allowed back in. All your clothes are in there, right? Everything else is in there. You've got to pay for some place to live. You know, you need to get clothes. You can't really keep taking the same clothes every day. Even if you relocate to a motel or a hotel that has, you know, laundry, you have one set of clothes. You know, it's like, and they usually don't like people going unclothed, walking down the hall into the laundry area and going back and getting their stuff later. It's not going to work. So you got to get all that stuff. You know, your toothpaste, your all your personal items. Yeah, a lot of stuff has to be done, right, to get done in there. So, yeah, there's a lot of work there. Payment for expenses for repair and rehabilitation of the homes and surrounding environment. For instance, power washing, air purifiers, air duct cleaning, water well testing expenses, all of which to see, you know, can you still live there? Do things need to be done, etc.? All of that stuff. Any medical expenses that were reimbursed by the railroad are there, right? Prescription medications that may be required by this. And there was a one-time inconvenience payment of $1,000. Apparently, the convenience of people in East Palestine, Ohio wasn't worth a lot, but they got $1,000. So it's better than nothing, even if not a whole lot better, but still better. And compensation to certain affected individuals who sold their homes if the sale was completed after the derailment. Obviously, after this took place, buyers were like, this can happen here. And that makes them a little less likely to want to buy the place. So, yeah. So, you know, obviously there's arguments that, in fact, their home sales were trashed by this, right? It's still near a railroad. So, obviously, over time, you'll argue that people realize that the chance of it happening there is not exactly lower than the chance of it happening at another town if they're buying a house close to the railroad track somewhere else. So, yeah, as it goes. Now, some things, though, are taxable. They will not be considered 139A payments, even though they relate to this. That includes any payments the railroad made for lost wages, lost income, right? Inability to operate your store, paid to you because, you know, you were, you know, your job was, you know, your where you worked was in there. So your job was, you know, you had, you know, you didn't get paid for your job because you couldn't do it for that period, the lost wages, all those sorts of payments. Any type of payment made to a business, businesses do not qualify for 139A reimbursement, right? You may still qualify for reimbursed expense type things if the expense itself would be deductible. So it offset each other, but you can't just say, you can't ignore it. And like I said, a major reason for that is because, yeah, a lot of these are reimbursing expenses that would be deductible. You're not going to get the deduction and exclude the income, right? So they're going to have that in there if you're making payments. Any payments made by the common carrier to access the track for remediation or to access creeks or streams for cleaning, right? Those payments they thought went a step too far. They don't qualify for this issue, right? For that issues, okay? Instructions for claiming the exclusions are found in Section 4 of the notice. If your return's not yet filed for 2023, you attach a PDF that states exactly what the notice tells you to state with your electronic forms, or you put a specific statement at the top of Form 1040 if you're filing on paper. Now, if you've already filed your 2023 return and you've included part of this as taxable, well, file 1040X with your claim for refund. And again, if you're doing it electronically, attach that same PDF, or effectively very similar PDF. And if you're filing on paper, you're going to put that similar title on top of the Form 1040X. Okay, final issue for this week. Let's talk about employee retention credit. What about claims stalled at the IRS? There was an article this week in Tax Notes Today by Lauren Loracchio. I can't pronounce your name, Lauren. I don't have the proper pronunciation. So I know that's not right, but we'll go with that. Frustrations mount over ERC processing delays. This is in Tax Notes Today Federal. Her article is on June 4th. The article discussed, and what we've heard from a lot of people, growing frustrations with the IRS over the processing of employee retention tax credit claims that were filed, especially those filed in 2023, the early parts of 23, before we got to the September moratorium on processing new claims. So we're talking about old claims for the most part here. I've also seen in the past week discussions in multiple CPA discussion forums. CPA Society discussion forums that are having clients who are getting, you know, and they're wondering, what can we do? You know, client wants to know, can't you do something? And so this article goes into the can't you do something? And the catch is your options are, well, clear, but from a practical standpoint, limited. So first thing is, there is no way, it appears, to force the IRS to act right now. We know, reported a little while back, that there is a lawsuit being filed by a firm here in Phoenix to try to force the processing to speed up, right? This would be a firm that was involved in, you know, basically was an ERC consultant. Now, yeah, there's a couple of issues with that lawsuit, one of which is where they have standing because they're, you know, in essence, their clients brought the claim. They of course, aren't getting paid until the claim is taken care of, so that's why they're a little iffy about it. Also, the next problem, I think, is going to be the bigger one that the courts are going to say, you know, because if, in fact, there was no recourse whatsoever at this point for the taxpayers, then I think the courts might say that, yeah, you know, this raises serious questions about equal protection, other issues, right, where the IRS appears to be, you know, blocking what in some of these cases will be legitimate refunds. Okay? A lot of cases they won't, but that's kind of our whole problem. What the catch is, if your claim was filed more than 6 months ago, so you filed your 941X more than 6 months ago, the code clearly provides that you do not have to wait for the IRS to decide yes or no on your claim. You can haul the IRS directly into U.S. District Court or actually U.S. Court of Claims right now and say, let's come here. We want to litigate this, get it done. We believe we can show we have a right to this refund. IRS, pay up or come to court. Right? We're done waiting for you to make a decision. And that would force the IRS's hand. The problem, though, is pretty obvious. That's going to cost a lot of money. And conceivably, it could cost more than the entire claim. Remember, there is no guarantee either that you get the claim. And I would also note that I don't know if any of these, any of these ERC consultants that offered, you know, might have said, oh, we'll back you, you know, we'll back you at the IRS, you know, we'll take care of that. We'd even, if they disallow your claim, we will pay to fight it. I bet it never said in your contract that they would, that at the 6 month date, they would pay for a tax court case without an IRS disallowance. And so now they're kind of in a tough position, right? The same thing there. Right, they're in a tough position because they have no way to move things forward, right? There is no, because it's not realistic. These people filed based on the assurances that, well, you know, the worst that could happen is the IRS disallows your claim. That may not really be the worst. We've gone down that path a few times, but you know, that yeah, you wouldn't have to pay money up front to get it. Now it appears if you want to get it and you want to force it anytime soon, you need to pay money up front because you need to go to district court. And that's a bit of a problem, right? Problems of going to court, as I said, pretty obvious. Cost may be greater than the refund claim or just a huge percentage of those claims. So, you know, and remember, you will still get, if your claim is allowed by the IRS, you will still get interest. So you want to go to court where the court may decide it's a closed case, so you're not going to get awarded fees, right? And pay all those fees. Or do you want to just wait and say, well, at least I'll get interest? I think a lot of people, when faced with that choice, are going to say, well, at least I'll get interest and go down that path. The case itself will likely take up quite a bit of time. So it's not as if you're going to file this thing. If the IRS decides to fight you on it, not as if you're going to file this claim and a week later have the check in your hand. It might happen if your case was very, very clear that you would eventually prevail. And so as soon as counsel looks at it, they say, just write the check. Okay, get rid of this. Write the check. There is no way we're taking this to court. But if your case is not that clear cut, then yeah, I would expect the service to fight you. So for that reason, it's kind of limited. Now, the article notes there are some cases in play right now that are going down this route and trying to get their refund. They estimated maybe 9 or 10 nationwide have actually filed in court looking to get their case heard by a judge instead of waiting for the IRS to hear it. My guess is, if I had to, those 9 or 10 are probably cases that are close to slam dunk wins for the taxpayer. And the idea is we push it here. We do the filing up front, but we're not really going to be going to court because the IRS, no way do they want this case going to court, right? They'll just settle as is. But the problem is, you know, if your case is not so clear cut or you just don't have the initial funds to pay for it, not probably going to work. But yeah, the problem with these 10 cases is because there's a high chance that most are very clear cut, it's not like we're going to get a case decided even from the set we have now, where we're going to actually decide some of the stickier issues. Some of the, this is close on whether or not this sort of partial shutdown situation would qualify. And that's a problem. It means you're actually looking far out. So the practical answer to your clients is, yes, there is something you could do, but you're not going to like it. And you're probably going to decide to just wait once you know what it is. Yeah, you can sue the IRS in court. And you're not suing them to force them to do something. You're not trying to plow new law ground in that. You're using the remedy that the law provides specifically, which is, if the IRS won't rule on your claim, you can basically get in front of a judge. So that's your option. Just not realistic for a lot of clients. So this has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of June the 10th, 2024. Current Federal Tax Developments brought to you by your stateside CPAs and Kaplan Financial Education. I do follow along, as I said, on certain discussion groups for state societies. So if you are a member of the Connect, so if you're in the Connect site for the Arizona Society, the Idaho Society, the New Jersey Society, right, Minnesota Society, or Illinois, and you just post there, then yeah, you know, if I see something, I might respond. Otherwise, you can email me, edzars@currentfedexdevelopments.com, and I'll see if I can get back then. I am going to be out of town for a little while this week, so I don't think that's going to impact my ability to get this out next week. Shouldn't, unless a lot of weird things happen. But I should be able to get at least most of the basic work done before I get back home on Friday. I've got a lot of time sitting on a plane. So we'll see if I can actually do a little bit there. Because this is the sort of work you can do on a plane because it's not confidential. It's out easily. So we'll see what goes on. But otherwise, we hopefully then will see you back here next week for more from Current Federal Tax Developments.